The Recollections of N. Balaram Reddy, Part 2, Third Visit to Sri Ramanashramam. About a year later, in April of 1936, I had to leave Aurobindo Ashram and return to my village in Andhra Pradesh for 2 months. My plan was to travel to Ramanashramam at the end of those 2 months and stay there for 7 weeks. In June of 1936, I arrived at the Maharishi's Ashram for a third visit. I was accommodated in the cottage next to Yogi Ramayya's. This cottage is on the west side of the ashram near Palakkuttu and was built by one of the yogi's disciples with my namesake, Balaram Reddy. This same Reddy was also responsible for building Yogi Ramayya's cottage. One afternoon, about 2:30 p.m., I casually strolled out of the north gate of the ashram and onto the hill, observing the majesty of the holy hill and studying the summit. A desire arose in me to climb up and see it. I was new in the ashram and had no idea how difficult this endeavor would be, especially since I desired to climb straight up from where I was. I mentally drew a straight line over the rugged slope and began my ascent. When I reached about halfway up, I met a group of ladies carrying firewood on their heads. They asked me where I was going. After hearing of my plan, they tried their best to dissuade me, saying, "The wind is very strong on the upper slopes and you will be blown off and fall to a death, or at least be seriously injured. No one frequents that area of the hill, and so you will not be found or saved. Please go back." I listened to the warnings which they offered in all sincerity, but as I was still a young man and felt strong, and as I had already climbed more than halfway up, I was loath to turn back in spite of all the dangers they described. Needless to say, after the ladies left, I continued my climb. It wasn't too long before the slope became very steep, and while it slowed me down, this did not discourage me in any way. I came to one point where I had to pull myself up on a narrow ledge. Sitting on that ledge, facing the plains, I realized that I was unable to stand without losing my balance. In other words, I could not continue my ascent from where I was. On one side of me, there was a dangerously steep precipice of more than 1,000 feet. On the other side, I saw an insurmountable vertical wall of rock. Then, to my great dismay, I realized that not only was I prevented from standing to ascend, I was so precariously positioned on this ledge that it was impossible for me to retrace my steps downward without tumbling head over heels to my death. And to top off all this distress, my sandals were now causing me to slip from the very ledge I was clinging to for my life. I carefully removed the sandals and let them fall down the slope. Sitting with my knees close to my chest and my feet up against my buttocks, I pondered my ill fate. I soon lost all hope of coming out of this ordeal alive. Closing my eyes, I began to think of Sri Bhagavan and the mother of Aurobindo Ashram. For about 10 minutes, I sat in this sad condition. While my eyes were closed, my head involuntarily turned to my left side. I opened my eyes and saw a clump of vegetation firmly rooted between some rocks. I looked at it and thought that perhaps I could grab onto that vegetation and pull myself up to a standing position. I caught hold of the growth and, to my surprise, executed the feat without much difficulty. And when I did stand up, I was utterly amazed when I looked over this ledge and saw that I had reached the summit. Slowly, I pulled myself up onto the summit and immediately exhaled a thankful sigh of relief. I walked over to the peak, looked around, and soon began my descent down on what appeared to be a frequently used path. Without difficulty, I reached the main road and followed it back to the ashram, arriving there just as the evening meal was being served. Without saying anything to anybody about my exploits, I sat down with the others and ate. This event, which was known to me alone, served to deepen my faith in the intervention of the divine hand. I saw it as an unforgettable milestone in my life of faith and devotion. During this visit, I carefully observed how the ashram was managed and how guests were accommodated and served, and seriously thought about what it would be like to live in the ashram permanently. The presence of the Maharishi, with all his majestic dignity and grace, was a force I could no longer resist. The thought that I might later regret such a move carried little weight when I contemplated the accessibility and spiritual power of the Maharishi. I thought to myself that even if it turns out to be a great mistake, I must not miss this opportunity. I became convinced that my place was there with the Maharishi. I then decided to return to Aurobindo Ashram, wrap up my affairs, obtain the blessings of Mother and Aurobindo, and return to Ramanashramam as soon as possible. Leaving Aurobindo Ashram, I had been with the Mother and Aurobindo for 5 years. During those years, they showered me with kindness and love while guiding me on the spiritual path. My gratitude and regard for them compelled me to obtain the permission and blessings before leaving. This turned out to be much more difficult than I imagined. In Aurobindo Ashram, it was the practice of the disciples who had doubts or questions to write them in the form of a letter to Sri Aurobindo. All the letters were daily collected and taken to Aurobindo, who would sit with the Mother during the nights and promptly answer them in writing. Sometimes we would see the lights burning all night as they were engaged in this work. Upon my return from Ramanashramam, I wrote a letter stating my desire to receive their blessings and permission to live at Ramanashramam. In the letter to Aurobindo, I wrote that since your yoga begins with self-realization, kindly permit me to go to Ramana Maharishi, who emphasizes only self-realization, a state I have not attained or may not even be worthy of attaining. Aurobindo's reply was affectionate but negative in regards to my leaving his ashram. He wrote, "Both self-realization and the supra-mental state can be simultaneously developed and achieved here. There is no need for you to go there." I was extremely disappointed at his response and consequently became frustrated, restless, and discouraged. I soon began to have sleepless nights and felt distraught. I then wrote a second letter to Aurobindo with the same request. Again, I was denied permission. It took a long 5 months and a third letter before Aurobindo and the Mother finally agreed, giving me their permission and blessings. Perhaps they realized I was determined to go, and they saw no other recourse but to grant my request. In Aurobindo's final letter to me, he wrote, "Since you were determined to follow a path in which you can achieve only partial realization, we give you our blessings, though we believe it would be better if you stayed on here and pursued your sadhana, where both the Mother and I can help you." It was the rule in Aurobindo Ashram that any letter written to or received from Aurobindo should not leave the ashram premises. So, to comply with this rule, I burnt all my letters except the final letter I received from Aurobindo. This I kept with the view of showing it to Bhagavan. Settling at Sri Ramanashramam, On 5th of January 1937, I finally arrived at Sri Ramanashramam for good. This happened to be the day after the Maharishi's 57th birthday was celebrated. As there was still a crowd gathered there for the festivities, I was accommodated with many others in a common guest room for men. Soon after, when nearly all the guests dispersed, I was given Yogi Ramaya's cottage to use. I then thought that I would use this cottage while the yogi was absent from the ashram, which was most of the time, and find other accommodations during his visits. This seemed to me to be a convenient arrangement. After all, I had now come to settle down there permanently with the Maharishi as my guru. But after only 1 month had passed, the ashram management informed me that though they didn't want me to leave Bhagavan's holy presence, it was not the practice of the ashram to accommodate devotees permanently. They respectfully requested me to find a place outside and gave me a 15-day extension to arrange it. During the early years, there were no houses anywhere near the ashram, as it was mostly jungle or forest. I eventually found an upstairs room in a Brahmin's house near the Arunachala temple in town. For my meals, I would sometimes cook small items in my room, sometimes obtain food from somewhere outside, and somehow manage without feeling inconvenienced. Daily, I would rise at about 3 or 4 a.m., walk to the ashram, stay in the hall with Bhagavan until 10 a.m., return to my room, come back again to the ashram at 3 p.m. and stay there until 8 p.m. It went on like this during the first year. If possible, I would always sit close to Bhagavan so I could hear all of his precious utterances. Soon after settling in Tiruvannamalai and surrendering to Bhagavan as my guru, I wrote in English on legal size paper a rather long detailed history of my life and handed it over to Bhagavan. In that letter of several pages, I poured out my heart to Bhagavan, withholding nothing. He carefully read through all the pages and then returned them to me. For the first few months after my arrival, Bhagavan would frequently start up conversations with me. With no apparent reason, he would start explaining to me a verse, some aspects of a certain philosophy or a certain spiritual practice. This went on to such an extent that S.S. Cohen, in a light way, complained to me, saying, "Why do you always make Bhagavan talk? I think I am getting jealous." I naturally protested, "I am not making him talk. For some reason or other, he simply looks at me and starts talking." Often, during these discussions, Aurobindo's philosophy would come up. And on some occasions, Cohen and Chadwick would also join in and try to dismiss any validity to Aurobindo's path. To my surprise, I would find myself defending his philosophy and easily crushing their arguments. S.S. Cohen, after repeatedly hearing about Sri Aurobindo, decided that the yogi from Pondicherry must have some greatness. Consequently, one day he travelled to Pondicherry and while there wrote a note to Aurobindo describing who he was, what he wanted from life, self-realization, and where he was then residing, Sri Ramanashramam. Cohen later showed me the reply he got from Aurobindo. It said in brief that all his aspirations could be fulfilled at Sri Ramanashramam, where he was then living. With them, I had an easy time, but with Bhagavan, it was a different matter. Whatever he would say on the matter was nearly impossible to dispute. I remember during my second visit to Ramanashramam, the Maharishi was one day reading a lengthy book review from a newspaper. The book being reviewed was Aurobindo's Lights on Yoga. The reviewer was Kapali Sastri and the editor of this newspaper was Bhagavan's devotee, S.M. Kamath. Bhagavan seemed to take great interest either review and would occasionally stop reading and comment on what he had just read to those sitting around him. When he had concluded reading it, someone who was aware that I had that very book with me said to Bhagavan, "This man has come from the Aurobindo ashram and he has that book with him." Bhagavan turned to me and said, "Oh, is that so? Let me have a look at it." I went back to my room, fetched the book and handed it over to Bhagavan. Immediately, Bhagavan began reading it intently. He kept on reading it well into the night with the help of a small oil lamp until he finished it. When I came into the hall the next day, he began discussing the book with me, telling me that a certain term used in the book might look like something new, but it is actually the equivalent of this other term used in such and such ancient text, etc. Like this, he went on discussing and comparing Aurobindo's philosophy for some time. So, Bhagavan thoroughly understood Aurobindo's philosophy, both intellectually and also from the standpoint of experience. One evening, I said to Bhagavan that the major attraction of Aurobindo's teachings is that it professes that immortality of the body can be achieved. Bhagavan made no comment. The next day, as soon as I walked into the hall and sat down, Bhagavan looked at me and began saying, "In Kumbakonam, there was one yogi, C.V.V. Rao, who was proclaiming to all his doctrine of the immortality of the body. He was even so bold as to declare that Dr. Annie Besant, a distinguished public and spiritual personality in India, would have to come to him to learn how to make her body immortal. But before he had a chance to meet Dr. Annie Besant, he died." This brief story clearly illustrated his point. On another day, not too long after settling near Sri Ramanashramam, I approached Bhagavan when no one was in the hall and showed him that last letter I had received from Aurobindo. Bhagavan asked me to give it to him to read. I told him he would be unable to decipher Aurobindo's handwriting as it was very illegible and only those who have studied it for some time could read it. He said, "Give it to me. Let me try." After looking into it and realizing he could only make out a few words, he returned it and asked me to read it out. I began reading it, and when I came to the sentence, "Since you are determined to follow a path in which you can achieve only partial realization," Bhagavan stopped me and said, "Partial realization? If it is partial, it is not realization. And if it is realization, it is not partial." This was the final blow that silenced all my doubts. I then destroyed this letter like all the rest. And because of all the discussions I had had with Bhagavan, I soon felt perfectly established in his teachings, having a clear understanding of where the Maharishi's path and Aurobindo's path diverged and went different ways. When all the clouds of doubts and distractions dispersed, so did our discussions. Bhagavan then knew that I understood and the foundation work had been done. The purpose of all our discussions were served, and so they stopped automatically. To be continued.